Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, commentary, and information about the African American community. This week, I'll have readings from Essence Magazine, the National Cancer Institute, BBC History Magazine, the New York Review of Books Magazine, the New York Times Newspaper, and I'm starting with this selection from the website BlackCatholicMessenger.org. The title of the article is Black Catholics React to Pope Leo XIV, the Creole. This was written by Nate Tenner Williams and published May 9, 2025. The curious background of Pope Leo XIV, the American formerly known as Cardinal Robert Prevost, is already making waves, with some calling the new pontiff the first black pope and others still looking for answers. New Orleans genealogist Jerry Onora dropped the bombshell on Thursday, May 8th, after white smoke rose in St. Peter's Square, calling attention to census data that indicates the new Bishop of Rome descends maternally from African-descendant Louisiana Creoles. The Pope himself was raised in Chicago, where his mother's family migrated in the early 20th century. An inauguration mass will officially enthrone the first American Pope on Sunday, May 18th, bringing thousands to Vatican to fete the new face of the Catholic Church. I invite you to reflect on the marvels the Lord has done, the blessings that the Lord continues to pour out on all of us through the ministry of Peter, Pope Leo told the College of Cardinals in English during a homily Friday morning, May 9th, at a live-streamed Mass in the Sistine Chapel. You have called me to carry that cross and to carry out that mission, and I know I can rely on each and every one of you to walk with me as we continue as a church. In his most recent post, a prefect for the Vatican's Dicastery of Bishops, Prevost advised Pope Francis on episcopal appointments and demotions around the world, including the 2023 removal of the far-right Texas bishop Joseph Strickland, a noted anti-Francis voice, from the Diocese of Tyler. Earlier that year, Tennessee Bishop Richard Stitka of Knoxville resigned under duress after successive scandals, an exit also influenced by Prevost. The Pope-to-be was also an outspoken voice on a variety of social issues, including racism, the death penalty, climate change, and poverty. He chose his papal name Leo XIV in honor of Pope Leo XIII, who reigned in the late 19th century, pioneered in Catholic social teaching, and condemned slavery in two papal documents. The social justice and unexpected ethnic connections have already begun to thrill Americans of various stripes, including many Louisiana Creoles who see Pope Leo XIV as one of their own. Father Claude Williams, an African American from New Orleans, serves in Rome as rector of the Collegio San Norberto, a house of the Norbertine order, part of the same tradition as the Augustinians, of which the Pope is a member. Williams' ancestors also worshipped in the same 19th century Crescent City Church as Pope Leo's, in the historic 7th Ward neighborhood long associated with black Creoles. My great-grandmother was baptized at Our Lady of the Sacred Heart in 1905, where his grandparents were married in 1887, Williams said, adding that he is grateful that the Augustinian charisma will be present in the church's highest office. The essence of the Augustinian rule is being one heart and one mind in God, he said. Our charism as Norbertines is communio, a shared hallmark of all Augustinian communities, the gift of intimate connection with God and in committed service to God's holy people. Leo's Louisiana roots, which are reportedly being investigated by the Archdiocese of New Orleans, are just part of the black Catholic intersection quickly taking shape in the media and elsewhere. Williams noted to Black Catholic Messenger that Pope Leo appears to have been born at the same Chicago hospital where Venerable Augustus Tolton, who rose from slavery to become the nation's first openly black Catholic priest, died in 1897. Father Kareem Smith of the Archdiocese of New York, who serves as president of the National Black Catholic Clergy Caucus, picked up on a similar theme and also called attention to the other African-American candidates for sainthood. We pray that this new pontificate brings greater recognition to the legacy of Black Catholics in America and renewed momentum toward the canonization of the Holy Seven, including Tolton, he said. That Pope Leo XIV's roots reach into the rich soil of Creole New Orleans is more than genealogical. It's providential. It affirms the often overlooked yet undeniable presence of Black Catholics in the very fabric of our church's history, a history that has too often been questioned or ignored. Sister Stephanie Henry, a Black Catholic who serves as congregational leader for the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament and who taught in New Orleans for years, also expressed joy in the election of Pope Leo XIV. Her order's foundress, St. Catherine Drexel, the famed heiress turned nun, was originally encouraged to enter religious life by Pope Leo XIV. It seems momentous that this election took place on May 8th, the former liturgical feast of Our Lady of the Blessed Sacrament, she said in a statement shared with Black Catholic Messenger. In times such as these, when many in the United States are wondering, what direction are we headed as a nation? Are we listening to God? God has spoken and He is calling us in America to His heart through this new election, she added, ending with a prayer for the new American pontiff. That was the article, Black Catholics React to Pope Leo XIV, the Creole. It was written by Nate Tenner Williams and published May 9, 2025 at the website blackcatholicmessenger.org. Next is a short reading from the May 2025 edition of BBC History Magazine. The title is, We Now Know How Many Enslaved African People Were Trafficked Across the Atlantic. This was written by Hannah Cusworth. The transatlantic slave trade was one of the largest forced movements of people in world history. Yet for decades, it was difficult to quantify. Then, in the early 1990s, an international team came together to solve this problem. The result was the Transatlantic Slave Trade Database, which showed that 12.5 million people were transported. Of those, 10.7 million survived the journey and arrived in the Americas. Many people, particularly in the United States and the United Kingdom, assumed that most enslaved people were trafficked to the United States. In fact, the database showed that fewer than 400,000 Africans were forcibly taken to the mainland North America. About 4.8 million arrived in South America and 4.7 million in the Caribbean. First published as a CD-ROM in 1999, the database was greatly expanded in the early 2000s to include the Portuguese trade in the South Atlantic. Re-released as an open access website in 2008, including details of an additional 7,000 journeys, it has been described as one of the greatest historical achievements of the 21st century. Though the database does not give us a rich picture of the experiences of enslaved people, it has been critical to understanding the scale of one of the world's worst human rights violations. That was titled, We Now Know How Many Enslaved African People Were Trafficked Across the Atlantic. This was written by Hannah Cusworth and appeared in the May 2025 edition of BBC History Magazine. My next reading is titled, How Do Black People with Cancer View Clinical Research? This was written by Nadia Jaber and published November 15, 2024, at the website of the National Cancer Institute and its website, cancer.gov. Findings from a small study suggest that more black than white, Asian, or patients of other races distrust medical research and have spiritual beliefs about medical research. The study asked about 100 people being treated for cancer whether they agreed with certain statements about research. The findings may help research staff talk with and recruit more black patients for clinical trials, said study's leader Charlene Gomez, a medical student at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. black people make up about 14% of the U.S. population, but only 5 to 7% of clinical trial participants. Clinical trial participation is important because it provides people with the opportunity to access emerging cancer treatments, tests, and approaches to improving cancer care. More black than non-black participants of the study agreed with statements like, "Medical research is designed to harm minorities," and "God determines wellness, not research." Gomez reported October 1st at the American Society for Radiation Oncology, ASTRO, annual meeting in Washington, D.C. "The findings give us insight into what people may be thinking," said Chika Madu, M.D., medical director of Florina Cancer Center at Staten Island University Hospital and chair of ASTRO's Community Engagement and Advocacy Committee. "But there were so many reasons why patients may not enroll in clinical trials," added Dr. Madu, who wasn't involved in the research. "These include external barriers to enrollment that may be inadvertently imposed by the clinical trials themselves," she said. "However, for new advances in cancer treatment or prevention to provide the most benefit to people from different racial and ethnic groups," she said, "people from those groups must be involved in the studies that produce those advances." And while diversity in clinical trial enrollment has improved slightly over the years, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, Dr. Madu said. The next section of the article is titled, "Spiritual Beliefs and Mistrust of Clinical Research." To better understand the factors influencing the decision to participate in clinical research, Ms. Gomez and her colleagues designed a 45-question survey that captures beliefs and perceptions related to medicine and research. From October 2023 to February 2024, they gave the survey to people with cancer who had completed radiation treatment at one of two Baltimore hospitals. A total of 97 patients completed the survey, including 27 black patients, 28%. There were no differences in age or insurance status between black and non-black patients. Black patients were more likely to be female, unmarried, and have lower household income. Also, a similar percentage of black and non-black patients had previously participated in a clinical trial, 16% versus 18%. More black than non-black patients agreed with statements like, "God determines wellness, not research," 27% versus 8%. "Research is designed to harm minority groups," 20% versus 0%. "Research could provide personal health information that they don't want to know about," 25% versus 4%. "Their community wouldn't gain anything if they participated in research," 30% versus 6%. The researchers are still collecting survey data, and it's not yet clear how heavily these beliefs and values would influence participants' decision to join a trial, Ms. Gomez noted. Studies have found, despite hesitations, black patients are interested in participating in research. The results indicate that doctors and trial coordinators should be prepared to talk with patients about their spiritual beliefs and mistrust of research, Ms. Gomez explained. And they should share information on what clinical research entails and the benefit it can provide to individuals and communities. However, medical professionals need better training and resources on these topics, she acknowledged. The next part of the article is titled, "Why Clinical Trial Participation is Important." There are potential risks and benefits of joining a clinical trial. An individual may not benefit personally from joining a trial, but their participation can benefit other patients, especially those in their population group. So when black people participate in clinical trials, it can help ensure that the treatments, tests, and interventions being studied work well for the black community. For instance, in a meta-analysis of four trials in which nearly 20% of the participants were black, researchers found that radiation therapy for prostate cancer worked better for black men than for white men. If you didn't have that much enrollment of black patients in that study, you would have never figured that out, Dr. Madu said. But on the flip side, when trials have low enrollment of black patients, their results can fall short for the black community. For example, relatively few black women were included in clinical studies of a genetic test used to guide treatment decisions for early-stage breast cancer. It was later found that the genetic test may be less accurate for black women than for white women. The final part of the article is titled, Understanding Patient Perspectives and Engaging Others with Shared Experiences. Black patients' spiritual beliefs and mistrust aren't the only reasons why they are underrepresented in clinical trials, Dr. Madhu said. A major barrier for many underrepresented patients is simply that they are never asked to join a trial. Some doctors make assumptions that some patients wouldn't be interested in or couldn't join a trial, Dr. Madhu explained, so they don't ask. It is not our job as doctors to make that determination, she said. Give the patient the opportunity. Ask them and let them decide whether or not they want to enroll in the clinical trial. Other barriers include the cost of participating in trials, such as for doctor's visits and transportation to appointments. And the criteria for taking part in trials often prohibit enrollment of patients with certain health conditions, which is more likely to be the case for people from certain racial or ethnic groups. If a black patient is hesitant to enroll due to mistrust, it's important to understand that their stance is justified, Dr. Madhu continued. Centuries of unethical research practices and inequitable medical care, structural racism in current healthcare systems, and personal experiences with discrimination by medical providers have eroded the trust of black Americans, she stressed. When it comes to talking with black patients about clinical trials and understanding their concerns, having a diverse workforce and having patient advocates who have participated in a trial themselves speak with patients are helpful, Dr. Madhu added. Community leaders and community groups are also great resources for speaking to people about participating in clinical research, she said. Humans are more likely to take the advice of someone who's walked in their shoes, she said. That was the article, How Do Black People with Cancer View Clinical Research? It was written by Nadia Jaber and published November 15, 2024, at the website of the National Cancer Institute, cancer.gov. Next on today's African American Hour are a couple of readings from and about Essence Magazine. The first is titled, Against All Odds, How Black-Owned Luxury Brands Are Winning. This was written by Jasmine Browley and published May 13, 2025, at the Essence.com website. In an era where luxury is no longer solely defined by exclusivity and heritage, a new wave of black entrepreneurs is reshaping the landscape, making high-end products more accessible and culturally resonant. These trailblazers are not only thriving in traditionally saturated markets, but are also meeting a growing demand for inclusivity and authenticity in luxury goods. Accessible luxury, often characterized by high-quality products at more attainable price points, is experiencing significant growth. The trend is particularly evident among black consumers who are increasingly seeking brands that reflect their cultural identity and values. According to a McKinsey report, black consumers are up to 2.3 times more likely than non-black consumers to switch to a black-owned apparel or footwear brand, highlighting a strong preference for brands that resonate with their cultural experiences. Moreover, black consumer spending on goods and footwear is projected to grow by about 6% annually, reaching $70 billion by the year 2030. This surge underscores the economic significance of black consumers in the fashion industry and the opportunities for brands that authentically engage with this demographic. In a study published by Bain & Company, the global luxury market is expected to surpass $400 billion by 2030, with black consumers playing a critical role in that growth. Despite economic challenges, luxury brands that prioritize cultural relevance and inclusivity have seen a 12% rise in brand loyalty among black millennials and Gen Z consumers. Entrepreneurs like Kendra Anderson, founder of Caviar Dream, are at the forefront of this movement. As the first black woman to own a nationally distributed caviar brand Anderson is breaking barriers in a market often perceived as exclusive. Luxury should be inclusive, Anderson asserts. Caviar Dream is about bringing a sense of indulgence to everyone, regardless of their background. Growing up, caviar was something I only saw on TV. I wanted to change that narrative for people who looked like me. When asked what inspired her to step into the world of caviar, Anderson spoke candidly about defying expectations. People implied that it was too niche, too white, too inaccessible. But that's exactly why I knew I had to do it. I want black women to feel like luxury is their birthright. Not just something to aspire to, she explained to Essence. Anderson's brand isn't just about democratizing access to luxury, it's also about community. We host tastings in neighborhoods that typically don't have access to gourmet experiences. I want people to taste, learn, and enjoy. No velvet ropes, no exclusivity, she shared proudly. Luxury is a feeling. It's not just about the product. It's about the experience of feeling seen, heard, and catered to. That's what I want for my community, she added. Despite economic uncertainties, the luxury sector has demonstrated remarkable resilience. During the Great Recession of 2008 to 2009, the luxury goods market experienced a 9% decline, yet it rebounded swiftly, showcasing the sector's robustness. According to a recent report by Deloitte, the global luxury market grew by 21% in 2023 alone, driven largely by emerging black-owned luxury brands and increased spending from communities of color. This resilience is partly attributed to the lipstick effect, a phenomenon where consumers continue to indulge in smaller luxury items during economic downturns. This psychological trend is especially prominent among black consumers, who are increasingly investing in luxury as a form of self-care and generational pride. Moreover, the luxury market's adaptability is evident in its response to recent challenges. For instance, during the COVID-19 pandemic, while many sectors suffered, the luxury industry leveraged digital platforms and personalized experiences to maintain consumer engagement. Brands like Fenty, Telfar, and Caviar Dream expanded their direct-to-consumer models, allowing them to maintain consumer loyalty and drive sales without reliance on traditional retail. People think luxury is the first to suffer when the economy dips, but it's the opposite, Anderson explains. Black consumers want to feel good, even when things are hard. That's why our brand has actually grown during uncertain times. The growth of black-owned luxury brands is also fueled by strong community support and a desire for cultural representation. Online communities such as the Facebook group Black Girl Luxury provide spaces for black women to share and celebrate their luxury purchases, fostering a sense of belonging and empowerment. These platforms not only support consumer engagement, but also drive sales and brand loyalty. I always tell people, support isn't just about purchasing, it's about amplifying. When someone shares our brand on social media or tags us in their experiences, it ripples through our community. That collective energy is powerful, Anderson emphasized. Platforms like Instagram and TikTok have become critical spaces for black luxury brands to flourish. Black influencers are increasingly showcasing their purchases from black-owned brands, leading to viral moments and driving traffic to these businesses. A report from Shopify noted that black-owned brands saw a 300% increase in online traffic after viral TikTok campaigns in 2024. As the luxury market continues to evolve, the success of black-owned brands in accessible luxury segments signals a promising future. By prioritizing cultural authenticity, community engagement, and inclusivity, entrepreneurs like Kendra Anderson are not only redefining luxury, but also setting new standards for the industry. We're not just selling caviar, Anderson concluded. We're selling a new narrative of what luxury looks like, and it looks like us. Anderson's story is a testament to how black founders are not just participants in the luxury space. They are reimagining it. In doing so, they are proving that luxury, when democratized, is more resilient and culturally rich than ever before. That was the article, Against All Odds, How Black-Owned Luxury Brands Are Winning. This was written by Jasmine Browley and published May 13, 2025 at the Essence.com website. Next is a reading about Essence magazine. The title is Clarence O. Smith, founder of Essence magazine, is dead at 92. This was written by Jeray Longman and published May 7, 2025 at the New York Times newspaper's nytimes.com website. Clarence O. Smith, who convinced skeptical advertisers of the power and worth of the black female consumer market in becoming a founder of Essence, the first general circulation magazine directed at black women, died April 21st. He was 92. Mr. Smith, who lived in Yonkers, New York, died in a hospital after a short illness, his niece Kimberly Fonville Boyd said. She provided no other details. Essence began publication as a monthly in May 1970, in an era when negative and sometimes hateful stereotypes of black women were commonplace, said Edward Lewis, who was one of four founders of Essence and who became its chief executive. We had to overcome this perception, he said in an interview. Clarence suggested that we start telling the story of black women as strivers. Mr. Smith, as the magazine's president in charge of advertising and marketing, made the initial pitch to reluctant companies that there were 12 million black women in the United States, who controlled a market worth more than $30 billion, and that the magazine would target 4.2 million of the more affluent among them, women between the ages of 18 to 45 who were urban, educated, and had increasing discretionary income. A confident and charming extemporaneous speaker, Mr. Smith had come well prepared with market research, colleagues said. But his challenge was evident from the outset. The first issue of the magazine carried only 13 pages of advertising, and the second and third issues fared even worse, with just 5 pages of ads apiece. But while the magazine with offices in Manhattan continued to face obstacles, its prospects improved. Circulation went from an inaugural run of 50,000 copies sold to eventually topping 1.1 million. The number of advertising pages grew to more than 1,000 yearly, attracting companies like Estee Lauder, Johnson & Johnson, and Pillsbury. And the rate for a full-page color ad went from $2,500 to $48,000 by 2001, according to Mr. Smith. Clarence was a relentless champion for the leadership of black women and the impact of our spending power that was ignored, Susan L. Taylor, the magazine's editor-in-chief from 1981 to 2000, said in an interview. The seed for Essence began to germinate in November 1968, when a small group of black professionals, Mr. Lewis, Cecil Hollingsworth, and Jonathan Blount, all strangers to one another, met at a Wall Street conference held to encourage African-American entrepreneurship. Mr. Smith joined the group 2 weeks later. It was a time of social and civil unrest in the United States, with urban riots, the assassinations of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, and the Vietnam War in its deadliest year. But it was also a period, at the intersection of the civil rights movement and the black women's empowerment movement, of increasing opportunities for the creation of black-owned businesses. The concept of a magazine for black women was championed by Mr. Blount, according to Ms. Taylor. His mother would say, "Why do I have to read magazines where I see no one who looks like me?" she recalled. Mr. Smith, a top salesman for Prudential Insurance, had been the most successful of the four original partners and the oldest, as Mr. Lewis wrote in his memoir, The Man from Essence, creating a magazine for black women. He was also the only one with a car. Astutely, he persuaded automotive companies like Ford, General Motors, and Toyota to buy ads, something they had seldom done in women's publications. The first cover of Essence was dominated by a close-up photo of model Barbara Cheeseborough, who wore an afro and a look that suggested authenticity as an equal to glamour. Inside, there were photographic essays on fashion and beauty, celebrating models of diverse skin tones. One article headline, Sensual Black Man, Do You Love Me? Explored the topic of black men dating and marrying white women. Another article focused on women who were active in the civil rights movement, from Rosa Parks to Kathleen Cleaver of the Black Panther Party. Given a preview of the inaugural issue, Philip H. Daugherty, the New York Times advertising correspondent, called it a handsome piece of work. Clarence O. Smith was born on March 31, 1933 in New York City to Clarence Smith and Millicent Frey. He grew up in the Williamsbridge section of the Bronx. In a 2005 interview with National Public Radio, Mr. Smith described the neighborhood of his youth, mostly black but with integrated schools, as a collegial place where parents taught their children values of both self-improvement and selflessness. We had a responsibility to grow up to be people who made a productive life and who looked after the larger community as well, he said. At Essence, to please advertisers, he pushed for more ads to be placed in the front pages and encouraged the magazine to produce special issues devoted to beauty or travel as ways to reach advertisers in those particular industries. He also hired an advertising sales staff made up of predominantly black women, noted Marcia Ann Gillespie, the editor-in-chief of Essence from 1971 to 1980. The resistance of white businesses to associate with a black woman's magazine was really intense, Ms. Gillespie said. And Mr. Smith, she added, was always trying to find a way through and around and was relentless about it. Failure was not on his to-do list. Mr. Smith played crucial roles in expanding the entertainment side of Essence with an annual award show that honored black women and with a cultural and music festival that continues to draw roughly 500,000 attendees to New Orleans each July. He was a futurist, said Barbara Britton, a former vice president of advertising at Essence. Of the original four founders, Mr. Smith and Mr. Lewis were the only ones who remained with the company long afterward. But their 32-year partnership began to deteriorate in the 1990s over a tangle of issues, personal and professional. Their final disagreement in 2000 was over the sale of 49% of Essence to Time Warner. Mr. Smith opposed it. Mr. Lewis wrote in his memoir that it was his belief that Mr. Smith didn't want to see a viable black-owned company sell out to whites. By 2002, Mr. Lewis owned more stock than Mr. Smith and had gained the upper hand in the company. Mr. Smith was forced out and received a buyout of $14 million after seeking $40 million, Mr. Lewis wrote. The two seldom spoke afterward. After leaving Essence, Mr. Smith started a record label and a travel business. Essence sold the remaining 51% of its ownership to Time Warner in 2005. In 2018, the magazine was sold to Richelieu Dennis, a founder of a personal care products company, and became fully black-owned again. Today it publishes 6 issues a year in print and has a robust online presence. Along with Miss Boyd, his niece, Mr. Smith is survived by his wife, Elaine Goss Smith, and a granddaughter, Denise Diaz. The Smiths' 2 sons, Clarence Jr. and Craig, died before him. Mr. Lewis and Mr. Smith should be celebrated for helping to validate the value of black female consumers and to shape the way black women were perceived. He came across as authentic, really believing what he was selling, backed up by research, Mr. Lewis said, recalling the magazine's early days. We were always prepared because we knew that we were selling a market that no one wanted to be a part of. That was the obituary titled, Clarence O. Smith, a founder of Essence Magazine, is dead at 92. This was written by Jure Longman and published May 7, 2025 at the New York Times newspaper's nytimes.com website. I'm going to wrap up this week's African American Hour with a profile of the writer Vincent O. Carter, who grew up in Kansas City, Missouri in the 1930s and 40s and wrote about his time living here. The title of this article is Return to My Native Land by Jesse McCarthy. This appeared in the April 24, 2025 edition of the New York Review of Books. Great novels are not always recognized in their own time. Often they lie waiting, as if in ambush, for the future to catch up with their achievements. "Nothing odd will do long," Dr. Johnson quipped to Boswell. Tristram Shandy did not last. Sometimes odd things outlive the savviest critics. When odd literary works happen to be written by black writers, it can be harder still to tell whether their neglect stems from discerning judgment or the censure of contemporary taste. William Melvin Kelly's 1970 magnum opus, Dunford's Travels Everywheres, a creolized answer to Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, was described as exhaustingly difficult to read by Kirkus Reviews and was out of print for half a century before its revival in 2020. We can agree or disagree, as people always have of Finnegan's Wake, about whether it's a good novel. But it seems unlikely that Joyce's Earwicker is an easier fellow to follow. Similarly, readers who have thought it important to read dauntingly epic novels like David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, written in 1996, have rarely been as willing to accord their attention to Leon Forrest's Divine Days, written in 1992, an African-American Ulysses set on the south side of Chicago. The fact is, ever since its beginning in the middle of the 19th century, the black novel has labored under a burden of expectations about what it should be and what it ought to deliver, which has ensured that any novelist who deviates, takes risks, or self-consciously experiments will find public approval or critical recognition even harder to come by. Vincent O. Carter's Forgotten and Very Nearly Lost, writings from the 1950s and early 1960s, are a case in point. Born in Kansas City, Missouri in 1924, Carter is one of the most underexplored figures in the cohort of African-American writers who came of age around the end of World War II. His early life is still relatively unknown. Much of it we have to glean from the pages of his only novel, Such Sweet Thunder, posthumously published in 2003 and republished this year by Pushkin Press. It is a portrait of a black childhood in Jazz Age Kansas City and the early years of the Depression, a turbulent and exuberant time when the city operated under the political boss Tom Pendergast, who helped make it known throughout the country as the Paris of the Plains. Carter grew up in a subsection of the 18th and Vine District, which, like so many other vibrant black neighborhoods, was raised in the 1950s to make space for highways that would facilitate white flight to the suburbs. His parents, Joe and Eola Carter, are the models for Rutherford and Viola Jones, the parents of the novel's hero, Marigold Jones. Like their fictional counterparts, they were teenage parents and working poor. Carter's father was a building maintenance man and later a bellhop, his mother a laundress. Drafted into the U.S. Army in 1941, Carter worked in a defense plant for a year before shipping out. He fought at Normandy in 1944 and marched to liberate Paris. In 1945, while waiting to be demobilized, he appears to have gone to England to try to study there, but ended up, after a short stay, returning to the United States, where he briefly worked as a cook on the Union Pacific Railroad before enrolling in Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, one of the country's oldest and most prestigious historically black universities. The poets Langston Hughes and Melvin B. Tolson graduated from Lincoln in the 1920s. He had a reputation on campus for being eccentric and introverted, given to wearing tweeds and smoking a pipe. After graduating, he moved to Detroit, where he spent 18 months working in an automobile factory and taking graduate courses at Wayne State University. In 1953, with $3,000 from his parents, he arrived in Paris following writers like Richard Wright and James Baldwin, who had both decamped for what the scholar Michael Faber called the Rive Noir. A series of souring encounters led him to move around Europe, first to Amsterdam, then to Munich, where he had American contacts from his time in the army, and finally to Switzerland. For details from this period of Carter's life, we have only his The Burn Book, a record of a voyage of the mind, which got to press through the support of another American expatriate, Herbert R. Lotman, who was living in Paris on a Fulbright and trying to write a novel while working at the French offices of Farrar, Straus, and Giraud. Carter sent Lotman parts of the novel he was working on, and Lotman returned words of encouragement. By 1963, the book was nearly complete, with the working title, The Primary Colors. Lotman was impressed and showed it to Ellen Wright, Richard Wright's widow, who was still living in Paris. With her support, the manuscript made its way to American publishers. None of the 11 publishers who read it over the next 5 years bought it, and so Lotman and Carter turned their attention to the Burn material instead. The Burn book was finally published in 1963. Aside from a perceptive review by Nona Balalekin in the New York Times titled Black Odyssey, White World, the Burn book received little critical interest. It quickly went out of print and did not resurface until the turn of the millennium, when Durrell Pinckney reintroduced Carter in a lecture series at Harvard. He had been given the Burn book as a gift by Susan Sontag and Robert Boyers, who had come across it in a secondhand bookstore in upstate New York. It is easy to see why the irony, melancholy, and wit and erudition of the Burn book caught their attention. Its range of reference and gentlemanly poise make it an exciting literary creation, though hardly an ideal book to have appeared during the high tide of the Black Arts Movement, when popular literary expression about race was delivered in a feverish, declamatory style. The central conceit is Carter's insistence on remaining in a foreign capital that simply doesn't know what to make of him. When a Bernese interlocutor cannot grasp that Carter is neither a musician nor a student, Carter slowly turns the mental gymnastics of the racist mind into a source of wry observational comedy. He has never or seldom met or heard of, though he suspects there probably must be, Negroes who write. I can literally see him straining his imagination to accommodate the new idea of me with which I have confronted him. I can feel him lifting me out of the frame of his previous conception of the universe, fitting me first this way and that, like a piece of a puzzle, into the picture of the writer his mind is conjuring up. He is struggling with Goethe and Rilke and Gotthelf and Harriet Beecher Stowe and me. Carter's arcane cosmopolitan ruminations, qualities that would have made the Burn book legible in what I have called the blue period of black writing between 1945 and 1965, were, alas, a terrible fit for the reading public sense of what black writing should be at the time of its release. Seeing no way forward, Carter retreated from writing. He devoted himself increasingly to spiritual practice and to life with his partner, Lisolette Haas, a Swiss dancer and yoga instructor. He died in Bern in 1983. The manuscript of The Primary Colors was long believed to have been lost or destroyed. Fortunately, Haas preserved it, and thanks to good fortune and his resolute persistence, Chip Fleischer, a native of Kansas City who co-founded the independent Steerforth Press, was able to track it down and publish it in 2003. Recognizing the importance of jazz to the novel, with its Charlie Parker-like zine of vernacular play, Fleischer gave it the now definitive title, Such Sweet Thunder, a braided allusion to two of Carter's artistic heroes, Shakespeare and Duke Ellington, who used Hippolyta's famous phrase for his 1957 tribute album to the Bard. The book begins in 1944 with Amerigo as a GI bivouacked to the front lines in northern France. Seeking kindling for a fire, he encounters a scrap of an American newspaper that the army had delivered for morale. This printed matter serves as a Madeleine that opens the floodgates of memory to a lost boyhood in Kansas City. The fictional paper is called The Voice, an obvious allusion to the legendary Kansas City newspaper, The Call, now one of the oldest and longest-running black newspapers in the country. Carter uses the paper not only to set up his retrospective narration, but also to emphasize that his novel would turn chiefly on the perspective of a black community regarding itself. Toni Morrison would make this something of a trademark when she started publishing her own fiction in the 1970s. In a late scene, the society pages meld with Americo's visions of his hometown. 18th Street spread out before him like a huge page of The Voice. All the buildings appeared as photographs, and the flickering signs as headlines. He breathed in and out the picturesque smells of barbershop and pool hall, drugstore and tavern, the Sunday afternoon heat, the slightly wilted after-church freshness of Sunday suits and dresses reflected upon the polished surfaces of parked and moving automobiles, agitated by nervous lights upon the marquees of theaters, the honking horns of taxis, and the voluble malevolence of friendly greetings. "Hey, Joe," cried one tall dark man to another tall dark man on the opposite side of the street. Just then, the streetcar rushed between them, casting the greeter's reflection on its windows like a chain of photographs whisked through the air. This dream pageant is a portrait of the beating heart of pre-war black Kansas City. But it is also a lesson Amerigo is learning about the power of owning the means of your own literary reproduction, and the differences it makes when the recording systems of the world reflect your agency and your place in the world back to you. Using the black newspaper both allegorically as a symbol of a historic community and formally as a choral voice, it is to me the masterstroke of Carter's novel. Despite these experiments with form, the plot of Such Sweet Thunder is conventional and easy to follow. Americo experiences difficulties and adventures as he roams further from the alleyway house in the black ghetto where he grew up. He falls in love with Cosima Thornton, a middle-class light-skinned girl whose father disapproves. Carter's prose was impressionistic and full of juxtaposition, like a Romare Bearden collage. It has a haze of innocence appropriate to boyhood, with accordion-like orthographic flourishes in its fluent black vernacular. "Z'always got an excuse," a fed-up Rutherford exclaims when Americo tries to get out of his homework again. "Boy, where in the world have you been?" worries Viola. When his friend notices his affections for Cosima, "Every time I see her in the cafeteria or in the hall, I see you, standing on the sitting not too far away, just gazing up at her like she was Lena Horne." Americo struggles to make sense of the city's outbursts of casual violence and its relentless reminders of racism. We watch him mastering the ethnic slurs for every group in the neighborhood and learning to read by making out the report of a lynching in the pages of The Voice. The book's cityscape is fastidiously accurate. The obsessive reconstruction of Dublin in Ulysses is clearly a model. Such Sweet Thunder is inspired by Joyce too in the stylizations of its prose, with stream-of-consciousness riffs and onomatopoeic language. Carter is interested in tracking the growth and development of consciousness through his hero's evolving mastery of English and his widening exposure to a world of art, ideas, religion, sexuality, and independence, a trajectory that echoes a portrait of the artist as a young man. It's no accident that Carter, who was effectively living in exile in Switzerland, just as Joyce was in Zurich at the end of his life, unites in Such Sweet Thunder the racial outsider's perspective of Leopold Bloom in Ulysses with Stephen Dedalus's during a jam session with the Count Basie Orchestra at the Reno Club. He stood before two small cannons facing the street with their nozzles aimed at the high stone wall with broad stone staircases on each end that led to the upper reaches of the park. "Commemorating the First World War," Rutherford remarked sarcastically, as a streetcar nudged its way through the traffic that swarmed around the staircases. He was swept into the thickening crowd of black folks where the song throbbed beneath the brutal clash of a cymbal, against the sobbing of an alto saxophone, quickening to the pulse of a bass fiddle, or the pertinent click of hickory sticks upon taut snares, or English cue banking an eight ball into a corner pocket for a quarter. We sense Carter's archival impulse, a desire to record and preserve the voices of the past, like the cry of the crawfish vendor Mr. Derby. "Get your red hot crawdads, crawdads, R-E-D hot." Americo learns, as children do, that his fascination with surface textures and appearances can tip over suddenly into unanticipated realms of adult significance. He remembered the squirming mass of bluish-greenish-gray creatures clamoring in the number 3 tub and squirming in their own vomit after Mr. Derby had poured the salt on them, like snow. And now, with a sense of pleasant revulsion, he broke off one of the sharp, barbed-edged pincers and sucked the juice from its hollow shell. He crunched the shell between his teeth and chewed it until the good taste was gone and spat it out. "People's like that," he heard Mr. Derby say. Americo and his fellow black residents of Kansas City were immensely proud of their hometown, which, despite its hardships, they imagine will go on improving into the future. But we know that in the span of a single generation, the vast majority of that world would disappear, decimated by so-called urban renewal, the highways, the rise of the projects, the war on drugs. Carter returned once to the United States in 1972 and saw for himself the devastation of what had once been a world of inter-ethnic vitality, violence, and creativity, between jazz on the radio and the gestures of aunties cracking wise, the timbre of men hailing one another in the street, and the rumble of streetcars, the pool hall slouch, and the preacher's lean in the pulpit. The dense matrix of communal black life in neighborhoods filled with poor working people with immense belief in their own talents and scorn for the racist forces regularly lashing out to remind them of their place. In a letter to Lotman, Carter lamented this lost world that, paradoxically, had flourished under segregation. "It had all changed, Herb. It was all different now. The people were gone and the houses were gone. In their place was a superhighway. Only the light was the same. Sunlight at 7 in the morning, at noon, at 5 o'clock in the evening when Dad used to come home from the hotel. Perhaps it was when I boarded the plane for New York that I realized that nothing had been lost. I had written it all down, that fabulous world of childhood, the world of Mom and Dad young, laughing and in tears. It was all in the primary colors, my way. And what I couldn't say, because one can never say it all, is written in my heart." Carter's project is more than the nostalgic story of one young man's personal emancipation. It is a sprawling social novel. The original manuscript ran for more than 800 pages that takes us into living rooms and bar rooms, hotel lobbies and packed streetcars, zones where the black ghetto borders Jewish, Italian, Irish, and Polish communities, with merchants from each doing business on the grand avenues. We visit the segregated world, the packed churches on Sunday resounding with the pompous, oracular charisma of black preachers, and see the savvy of their political organizing and the thundering enthusiasm of their congregations. The novel admires the idealism of the well-to-do strivers, even as it pokes fun at their snobbery and petty squabbles, the teeming frivolity of the social clubs, the Mary Wee Social, the matinee matrons, the forget-me-not girls, the mysterious few whist club, brave little outpost of middle-class normalcy in a hostile white world, as Roy Wilkins, who got his start working at the Call, and who I believe is the basis for the character of the newspaper editor Robert Jordan in the novel, once called them. The novel's great achievement is its sense of voice, its rolling river of sound, the seedy life of back alleys, the slick talk of gamblers, the bravado of prostitutes, the argot of jazz musicians, the gossip and guile of laundresses, the jingle of the crawdaddy criers, Satchel Paige's games with the monarchs called over the radio, the earthy piano of Mary Lou Williams, the distinct vocal style of the Kansas City crooner Fa Terrell, and his brief turn in the limelight. It all flows together in picaresque sequences, without clear breaks, the orchestration of its collective voices swinging like a jazz ensemble, playing the changes in the key of black life. Most Americans today, including many black Americans, cannot seem to imagine that black Kansas City was ever anything other than the crossroads of highways, banks, convention centers, and empty lots that it is now. You can visit museums that have to stand in for a living fabric that was ripped away. Carter wants us to see and feel the magnitude of this loss, specifically what that loss was meant to African Americans and, beyond that, Its Tragic Significance in the Arc of American History. His work stands, testifying on behalf of millions who never could, for the unpardonable ruination of that nascent black working class, the squandering of the heroic efforts undertaken by the pioneering generation of black freedmen, the formerly enslaved and the sons and daughters of the formerly enslaved, who took off their shackles only to get to work building up black neighborhoods across American cities, everywhere under duress and festering resentment, and often under the hooded watch of Klan terrorism and Jim Crow apartheid. Other classics of African American literature know these people and tell aspects of their story. William Attaway's Blood on the Forge. Ernest J. Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. Margaret Walker's Jubilee. Richard Wright's Uncle Tom's Children. And Lorraine Hansberry's A Raisin in the Sun, to name a few. To my mind, none capture so aptly as such sweet thunder the note of gallant hopefulness, the vivacity, sarcasm, and cunning that generation seems to have possessed in such abundance. That was a profile of Kansas City-born author Vincent O. Carter. That was the article, Return to My Native Land, written by Jesse McCarthy, which was a profile of Kansas City-born author Vincent O. Carter. This appeared in the April 24th, 2025 edition of the New York Review of Books. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.